You have found Authentic Business Adventures, the business program that brings you the struggle stories and triumphant successes of business owners across the land. Past episodes of the Authentic Business Adventures podcast can be found on the podcast link at drawincustomers.com. We are locally underwritten by the Bank of Sun Prairie. My name is James Kademan, entrepreneur, author, speaker, and helpful coach to small business owners across the country. Today, we're welcoming slash preparing to learn from John Warlow, who's super awesome. He's the author of Built to Sell, which you've probably seen, host of the Built to Sell podcast, and founder of the Value Builder System. So, John, how are you doing today?
I'm great, James. How are you?
I am excited because, one, I'm familiar with your book. I have to apologize because I was not familiar to your podcast until you reached out. But the Value Builder System, I just recently learned that I actually hired a coach that used that software.
That's awesome.
It was incredible. So we have a lot to talk about, I guess, as far as that goes.
Sounds great.
So let's go back way back in time and just tell us, how did you end up in this whole helping people sell their business or value their business world?
Yeah, it goes back a while. 20 years ago, I used to run a market research company, and I built it up to, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 million in sales, probably 25, 30 employees kind of thing. Wow. And it was profitable. Okay. It, you know, we had, you know, month to month, maybe 20 to 30% profit margins each month. So it was a good business. Yeah. And we had great clients. We had Bank of America, Microsoft. These were all clients of ours. And so I decided I want to sell it. And I went to see a guy named Perry Miele in Toronto. And I said, what do you think it's worth? Kind of rubbing my hands together, waiting for the number.
Yeah, right?
And he said, you know, he said, well, it kind of depends on the answer to a couple of questions. I was, shoot, what do you, you know? He said, well, you're in the research business. So who does the research? And I'm like, well, those, you know, I'm involved in some of the research, right? It's big clients. So I can't, you know, step away. And he's like, okay, well, who does the selling? And I'm like, oh, yeah, like I'm involved. It's Bank of America. Of course, I've got to do some of the selling. He's like, all right, let me get this straight. You've got a research company. You're doing the selling. You're doing the research. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, like I could feel the, the hair on the back of my neck going up. And he's like, John, I can't sell your company. There's nothing to sell. It's worthless.
Ouch.
And I started to rebut him, right? Like, I'm like, but you got to be kidding me. Like Microsoft, Bank of America, like they don't want, and he's like, they don't care about a client list. They care about a business that they can run without you. And as long as you're in the middle, it's worthless to them.
Right.
And man, I'll tell you what, I left that meeting feeling like about this tall. And And anyway, I left that meeting and spent, you know, 2 or 3 years really transforming that business. Mm-hmm. We built a subscription model. We hired salespeople. We got me out of doing a lot of the work. And ultimately, it was acquired by a publicly traded New York Stock Exchange listed company. So like it had a happy ending.
Okay.
And that really sort of started my journey into helping other owners who may have experienced something similar, where they're told, hey, their business isn't worth what they thought it was, or maybe they want it to be worth more than it is.
Right.
Kind of how to basically think about improving the value of your company. So that's kind of mm-hmm. what I do.
Very cool. Very cool. So once you sold your company, I imagine to a company that size, you probably did okay stepping out of that role.
And we moved to Europe and
Nice.
spent okay. 3 years in a little village called Aix-en-Provence, where we raised our kids and lived like expats. It was the most incredible time of our lives. Like the thing about the school system is in France is that you have 6 weeks on, 2 weeks off throughout the whole year.
Okay.
So they take 2 weeks in at the end of October for a vacation called Toussaint. And then they have another 2 weeks at Christmas, another 2 weeks in February. They don't have as long a summer break, but they have like these mini breaks. And so we just made it our mission to get in the car every 6 weeks and go to another part of Europe. So we went to Spain and Italy and Sweden and Denmark and all over England and Wales. And I mean, it's just the most incredible time of our lives.
Oh
great.
My gosh. That's
yeah,
awesome. Really How old cool. were your kids at that time?
Kids were young. So they were 6 and 4 at the time.
Okay.
So, and then we were there 3 years. So when we came back, they were 9 and 6, something like that.
All
nine
right.
and seven. Yeah. It was fun. So, and I think, you know, to go back to what we're talking about today, and I mean, that's, I think, one of the true blessings of running your own company. Gosh knows there's enough problems, right? Like enough headaches. But one of the great benefits is that you can take a step off the career ladder. Mm-hmm. It's not like going to work at Microsoft or Procter & Gamble where you've got to get to the next rung on the ladder because there's a guy behind you or a gal behind you who wants your spot, right? Unless you keep going up, you kind of get kicked out. And if you take a pause and say, I want to take a sabbatical, I want to leave for a year, I want to leave for 2 years, that's basic career suicide in Procter & Gamble. And yet, as an entrepreneur, your skills are timeless. They are transferable. If you can start a business in 2021, you can start one in 2031. Like, it's same skill set.
Totally fair.
I think that's really important. And it's one of the tremendous luxuries of being an entrepreneur is you get to take a year off or 2 years off to go do something for you. And I think that's, and you don't, your skill set and your career trajectory doesn't have to suffer.
Very true. Yeah, it's interesting. After I sold my first business, I still had two businesses, but they were not nearly as involved as that first one. And I took that time to write my first book. That just kind of accidentally happened. It wasn't like, hey, I'm going to sell my business and write a book. It was just like, what do I do now?
Right. I'm a young guy. Like, what do I, exactly.
It's one of those like, okay, I sold the business. It's now somebody else's blessing and curse. What am I going to do today? And I just could not, maybe it's the whole Midwest work ethic or something like that. I couldn't just go to a beach. I don't know if we had a beach to go to, but anyways.
No, I was one of those, just
got to do something.
Yeah. I was in the same boat when we were in Europe by the third year, I was kind of getting a little bit antsy. Like, I need to do something.
I bet.
And, for the book, I'd written the book Built to Sell. And so in the back of the book, we said, go to builttosell.com and you can take a little questionnaire about how sellable your company is.
Oh, nice.
And so this was sort of the way that we'd originally thought about selling books. And I was starting to get calls from like brokers and consultants and saying, hey, could we license that questionnaire you put on your website to evaluate if someone was sellable or not? I'm like, after like the fifth phone call, I'm like, hold on a second. All these coaches and consultants and brokers want like tools
to
help evaluate the businesses. Anyways, and that ultimately led to Value Builder, the company you referenced at the beginning, which is a
nice
management software. Yeah. So that's how it all came up.
So tell me, how did you end up writing Built to Sell? Did that come about as you were going through the process of selling your business and transitioning from essentially a job owner with employees to a business owner and being able to sell, or did that come about after?
Yeah, after. So it's funny. My lawyer, he said, you've got a lot in common with another client of mine, a guy named Tom Deans. And Tom Deans had recently written a book. I don't know if you've ever had Tom on the podcast, but he wrote a great book called Every Family's Business. And my lawyer said, you should meet Tom. I'd never met him before. He happened to be in the same city as us.
Okay.
And so I said, sure. And we met, we had lunch totally out of the blue. And he had written this book, and it was a parable about the dangers and follies of transferring a business to your kids. And some of the big traps there. And he heard my story and he's like, John, you got to write this stuff down. And I left that lunch, no word of a lie. And I went to the top floor of our house and I started typing. And that's what triggered the initial manuscript for Built to Sell.
Very cool. So at that time, this is of interest to me because I'm speaking at When Words Collide, which is actually in Canada.
Oh, great.
In August. So at that time, when you were writing your book, writing the manuscript for the book, did you have a plan for publishing or marketing or selling the book? Or was it more just something to give the clients and stuff like that?
No, I didn't have any clients. I'd left the company that had bought our business. And I was literally, there was no back end. It wasn't part of the funnel. It wasn't part of a sales strategy. And that's, so many nonfiction business books. I mean, it's
how
we win companies. It's a glorified business card. Yet at the time, that was not the motivation. And I think in funny way, it was a very pure book in that respect. Cause there wasn't, I've since written The Automatic Customer and The Art of Selling Your Business, which were more really books to support the business value builder. So they were a bit more like I was writing things like, I should, include this because that references this part of our business. So it was much less pure, but Built to Sell was actually I didn't have a grand plan. I didn't have a publisher. I didn't know what I was doing. I just
started. All right, that's writing. Cool.
Yeah.
That's cool. So how did you end up, I guess, once you had it written and you're like, whoa, I got this manuscript. What's next steps? Did you end up self-publishing or going through traditional publisher or Vanity Press, or I'm just learning about all this stuff. So
Yeah, it was a vanity project in a way. I self-published it. I worked with a kind of a contractor who sort of helped me design the book and hired an editor and so forth. And I somehow got it to a guy named Bo Burlingham. I think I was writing for Inc.com at the time. And Bo, who's a wonderful guy, he wrote the book, A Stake in the Outcome with Jack Stack.
Okay.
He wrote The Knack with Norm Brodsky. He wrote Small Giants, which is probably his most famous book. Many, many other books. Anyways, I somehow must have gotten it to Bo. I can't remember if I cold called him or sent it to him. And he emailed me back. And Bo was an editor at large for like 25 years at Inc. magazine. He's like, he's got a big profile, wonderful guy. Yeah. And so I was really caught off guard when he actually reached out to me. He said, this book is actually halfway decent. You really should think about getting a publisher. And I was like, how does that work? And he's like, well, first thing you do is you need an agent and you're going to call my agent. And so he gave me the name of his agent and I called her up and I said, Bo told me to call you. And she said, well, if it's a friend of Bo's, I'll, you know, and she read it and she said, yeah, it's a, you know, and I don't mean to equate it in any way to this book, but she said it really feels like a modern day e-myth. And to me, I'd been given the e-myth as a kid, right? Like,
yeah,
go read the e-myth. It's kind of like the Bible for entrepreneurs, or it's the first thing you read, right? It's like, it's everybody's sort of go-to book. Mm-hmm. And to be even mentioned in the same breath as Michael Gerber, I was like, oh my gosh, that's very generous.
Yeah.
And, but so anyway, she sold it to, Random House, that like the big publisher in New York and,
nice.
And they kind of, you know, gave it life. So here we are.
That's very cool. So yeah. I want to go a little bit down the rabbit hole of the whole publishing thing.
Yeah.
Because, I'm talking with a lot of authors. I wrote a few books, but there were no, I guess I didn't have the patience to find an agent or publisher, and maybe part of it is I don't want to have the patience and then being denied. So I'm like, it's 20. I don't know if that was 2017 back when I published that. Self-publishing all the way, click a few buttons and away you go.
Yeah.
So I was talking with these authors and who I'll call pseudo masters or teachers, because I don't necessarily know if they know what they're talking about, but they seem like they do. And they tell me, hey, if you self-publish, you'll never get published by one of the big ones because they look down on self-publishing.
Mm.
And my thought was, I'm cool with that. But my other thought was, how do you know that? So it sounds like your experience was opposite of that.
It does. Yeah. And look, I don't hold myself out as a publishing expert. So I'm happy to share my experience, but
that's enough.
Yeah. I mean, like when I wrote like Built to Sell with self-published, as I described, when my agent pitched it to Random House, they said, you know, like we like the book, but we need, if we're going to publish it under our masthead, it really needs another chapter or another section to make it appear like a brand new book, because Built to Sell, the self-published one, had been in the marketplace for a few months.
Yep.
And, you know, we're not into publishing, you know, secondhand books kind of thing. Like we want it to be a fresh, brand new book. And so we added like a whole kind of implementation plan to that book. And that was that. So yeah, no, I didn't get a sense that there was any sort of looking down on the self-published route. I think, you know, there's all sorts of, you know, publishing, I think, has become in people's minds, certainly people on the outside look at it as sort of polarizing. Like you're either a self-published author and it's really just a vanity project and there's no legitimacy to it whatsoever, mm-hmm. or it's, you know, some six-figure advance from Simon & Schuster. And they're like, those are the two options.
Yeah, right?
Actually, the reality is there's lots of shades of gray in between there, right? Like lots of points on that continuum. You know, there's this hybrid publishing model now where it's quasi legitimate publishing. And there's also, and there's also legitimate publishers who give like really low advances if you promise to buy a truckload of books yourself. And like, that's no more vanity publishing than a self-published book. So like there's everywhere in between of that spectrum. And I think it comes down to, at least for me, like what's the business objective for this book? What's the potential audience? You know, why am I writing it, et cetera.
Right. So after you wrote the book, or as you were writing the book, it sounds like the value builder system came to fruition, or you had the idea for it.
That's right.
Is that the idea? And then
yeah. So yeah, when we were promoting Built to Sell, mm-hmm. I bought builttosell.com, the website. And again, on the website, we had this questionnaire, how mm-hmm. sellable is your company? And that's how, you know, advisors started to find us. And that's when the kind of light bulb moment went off and said, okay, I should start a business providing, you know, practice management tools to advisors right. who want to reach this market.
Nice. All right. So then when you decide, hey, I'm going to start this business, you had talk to your wife and say, hey, I'm going to start another business. And then did
and she's
you do
like,
the coding?
Thank God, or? Get out of the house.
That's awesome. Did you do the coding originally, or did you hire out?
They wouldn't let me near that. I worked with a couple of different firms over the years. And since then we've got a team on staff that does the coding, but we still work with some folks from overseas that do some of the kind of heavy lifting. Mm-hmm. We've got a VP engineering in Toronto who does the sort of, the strategic thinking and the overall planning for the tool. But yeah, we've got a team outside of, the country who does some of the development work.
Nice. And how difficult was that to essentially put what you had in your mind as far as valuation into this software tool via the programmers?
Yeah, it's tough, man. Like I would tell you, you know, a lot of people want to productize their service or build a technology software from a service business. And it's a tough transition. I just did a podcast with a woman who made that shift. She had a insurance brokerage, and she got fairly low multiples for her first two companies. I think she got like 1.5-2 times profit, and she thought, I want to do better. So she changed her consulting business into a technology business. She took basically all of her processes and systems, and she made them essentially a software product and system.
All right.
And she ultimately sold that company for 8 times EBITDA, or 4 times what? Yeah. So like a much, much, much bigger exit than her first two.
Wow. And,
but she's only, I think, somewhat among the minority. I think it's very common for service-based businesses to want to have a product-based business or to want to have a technology business because they're aware of the heightened, the better multiples. But it is, it's much, much more difficult. I think one of the challenges is that as service business owners, I think we are hardwired to want to create a custom solution for the client, mm-hmm. right? Like we grow up around solution-based selling and consultative selling and finding out what the customer wants and providing them with a solution. All these things, they sound good on paper, but effectively what that means is you're creating a custom solution for every customer.
Right.
And as long as every project is different, there's no way you can scale that business, because in order to grow it beyond you, you need to be able to hire people. And, you know, as long as you're doing a different custom job for every project, you're never going to be able to hire good people to be able to run the business without you. So, so that's one of the traps I think a lot of service companies fall into when they make the transition.
You know, it's interesting and extremely coincidental that you mentioned that, because so I have a call answering service. We have agents, we're completely customizable, and we're growing to the point where we're scaling very quickly. So 2021 has been a boon for us, but now we're learning where the little things are that we do that are not necessarily scalable, or not scalable the way that we're doing them. And one of those is the customizable thing, just in the brain or the memory power of each of the agents trying to remember or be fluid with all of those different systems.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. We're having to break off into pods so that not every agent knows every client, which is a huge paradigm shift, but one that we knew we'd have to go to eventually, but I didn't know it'd be today.
Yeah. Or didn't want it to be today. Yeah. We talk a lot about most small businesses, I'm talking kind of sub 20 employees, most small businesses sell a lot of things to a few people.
Right.
So think of I was doing a podcast yesterday for a guy who does a bunch of work in construction. Like think of the guy who comes in and does a kitchen, does a bathroom. Mm-hmm. Well, every job is different, you know, lots of different clients. And that's really the essence of an unsellable business, selling lots of things to a few people.
Right.
The opposite is a very sellable business where you sell one or two things to lots of people.
Right.
And so when you think about your telephone answering service, it'd be like, it'd be interesting to think through, like, how can we narrow what we offer, mm-hmm. kind of reduce the level of customizations that we're offering, mm-hmm. and really start to zero in on one thing. I'm reminded of an interview I did with Stephanie Breedlove. I'm not sure if you've ever had Stephanie on the show. She's an amazing entrepreneur.
Okay.
She does, she did payroll for nannies. So,
if oh, really?
If you're like a parent who has a nanny to pay, you call up ADP like Stephanie did in the early days, and they will give you a crappy customer experience.
Right.
They'll like bounce your call around to six different people, and it's not a great experience, right? Because mm-hmm. they want to do payroll for Procter & Gamble, for Ford. They don't want to do it for, you know, you and your nanny.
Right.
And so Stephanie realized there's a business opportunity here. And so she started this company, Breedlove and Associates. They do payroll for parents who have a nanny to pay. So she built it up, and she told me she reached about $300,000 in revenue. So it's like Stephanie had one employee.
Okay.
And she reached a fork in the road where it was getting harder for her to use her personal network to win new customers. Mm-hmm. And so she's like, she's at this fork in the road, she's like, what do I do? Do I sell more to my existing customers?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Which every business pundit was telling her to do, because it's like 8 times easier to cross sell another service to an sure. existing customer. Right. So you feel, you know, you got busy parents. What else do they need? Well, they need like meal delivery services, and, you know, like lawn care, like all this stuff. Right. And then the other road, the much more difficult road, was to sell, find more parents who had a nanny to pay, effectively double down on her strategy of doing payroll for nannies.
All right.
And so she gets to the stop at $300,000. She's like, I'm going to take the harder road. And so she grew much more slowly over 25 years. Think about it. It's 25 years.
Wow.
She built it up to $9 million in revenue.
All right.
This is not, but it's not Google. It's not Tesla. I mean, this is it's a slow burn. Oh, like
that's a more realistic number
totally,
as far as businesses right? go than a Google or a Tesla.
But check it out. She builds it to 9 million in revenue, 10,000 customers. And she decided that she wanted to sell. And mm-hmm. she went out and looked at who would be the most strategic acquirer for the company. And at the time, care.com was in an aggressive growth mode. Care.com is like the Angie's List of care providers.
Okay.
You plug in, I live in Madison, Wisconsin, and you press search, and out comes all the babysitters that have been rated 5-star in Madison, Wisconsin. So you can hire one feeling confident that you've got someone who's going to take care of your kids.
All right.
Cool offering. Well, at the time they had 7 million subscribers. And so Breedlove went to them and said, look, we've got 10,000 customers here. We're doing 9 million on 10,000 customers. You've got 7 million subscribers, all of whom need to pay their nanny or pay mm-hmm. their babysitter. Like if 1% of your 7 million buy my payroll service, like that's a company 7 times the size of my business today.
Right.
Right. If 2%, 5%, I mean, it's incredible. Anyway, long story short, care.com acquired Breedlove's business for $54 million.
Whoa, that's a multiplier.
Holy cow. Think about it. This is not a $9 million profit business. This is a $9 million revenue.
Right.
Right. And so she got 6 times top line revenue.
Wow.
My point is, when it comes to making your company more valuable, an acquirer is going to look at your business and say, is there something here that they have done that is so unique that it would take us years and many millions of dollars to do exactly what they're doing?
Mm-hmm.
Right. If the answer to that is yes, then the chances are they're going to pay a premium for your company. If you're mm-hmm. just selling a bunch of commoditized products and services, if you're selling a lot of things to a few people and none of which you're truly differentiated on, mm-hmm. they're not going to want to buy you. They're going to want to just compete with you. They'll enter a price right. war. They'll outbid you for jobs. And mm-hmm. But if you have the courage, when you reach whatever the $300,000 fork in your road is,
mm-hmm.
where you're like, I'm going to double down on my original proposition. I'm not going to take the easy route and start cross-selling a bunch of stuff.
Right.
I'm going to just do one thing. That's when you build real value into your company.
Interesting. I like that. You know, it's interesting, I guess, anecdotally here, when I was using the coach that was using the Value Builder system, on your software, you had little dials where you could adjust mm-hmm. it.
Yeah.
And my thought was that it was going to take in the neighborhood of 6 months to negotiate back and forth, find a buyer, all that jazz, which that was pretty accurate. And I figured if I was buying this business, or I take that back, if I was considering buying this business, And because the dollar amount for this particular business was six figures, it wasn't crazy seven figures or something like that. Mm-hmm. My thought was, how much would I have to spend in marketing to essentially duplicate the brand awareness that my company had?
Yeah.
So instead of just buying James's company, I'll just spend some money on marketing, get the name recognition equivalent that he has. How much would I have to spend? So it's interesting, I guess, comparable. I was looking at marketing where you're looking at just the utility of it. Or the expansion or the customization of it.
Yeah, you're looking at almost like the replacement value. I mean, it's not exactly apples to apples, but
right.
You know, when you sell a company, the cheapest way you can unload your company is to sell its assets, right? Like sell the desk, sell the trucks, and you can sell just about any business by selling the assets, right?
Sure.
There's a market value for that stuff. Yeah, not very much. It's got a liquidation value, but you can sell it.
Yeah.
What you really want to do, I think the kind of job description of an entrepreneur is to maximize what accountants call goodwill, which is the difference between what you sell your company for and the value of your hard assets.
Right.
That's called goodwill.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're just buying, you know, what it would take to replicate the kind of brand equity you have, they're not really buying a lot of goodwill in there.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little bit, but not a lot. What buyers really care about is your future stream of profits. So they're trying to figure out, like, is this company gonna create profits in the future? And if so, how reliable are those estimates? And that's what drives up the value of your company. If you can make the case that your business is bulletproof and it's kind of an annuity stream and it kind of chunks along without a lot of involvement from you, like that's a really valuable company. And that's why recurring revenue is one of those big drivers of value in your company. If you could create some recurring, and when I mean recurring, I mean like it's automatic. You don't have to stimulate demand. You don't have to get customers to buy. They buy automatically, either on like a service contract or a subscription or something. Those businesses tend to trade at much higher multiples because they're more predictable. And buyers are looking to buy future profits, and they pay more when they can feel confident that, yep, that future profit stream is going to continue.
Yeah, that's cool. So one of the things that I want to ask you about with the Value Builder system is it had to take a lot of homework to figure out what industries have what multipliers and all that jazz. There's a lot of, I guess, a lot of numbers or a lot of verticals that go into the whole algorithm to figure out what the what the end number is, I guess, as far as that goes. How did you figure that out?
Just through quantitative market research. So when my former company was a quantitative market research business. So when we went to build the algorithm, we did a big quantitative market research study and looked at offers being offered to business owners, what industry they were in and what drivers. And interestingly, the industry does definitely impact the value of your company. A SaaS software business is trading at a much higher multiple than a graphic design studio, as an example. But I think we oftentimes run a little bit the risk of feeling like our valuation is preordained, meaning we're guaranteed to get the prevailing multiple because plumbing companies are trading at 5x EBITDA. Therefore, I should get 5x EBITDA.
Right.
And I think we've seen at Value Builder instances where companies can earn more than 2x the prevailing valuation if they focus not just on the industry they're in, but on some of the other things that we've talked about today.
Mm-hmm.
Equally, I've seen instances where companies get less than half the prevailing valuation, even though they're in a very attractive industry. Because they, the structure, there's things about the structure that draw down the value of your company. So I think I think industry is important. It's a major factor to the value of your company, but don't sort of go in with horse blinders to say that's the only thing that matters, because there's lots of other things. Recurring revenue is like is a big one. Having one thing that makes you really unique is what we refer to as monopoly control. It comes from the old Warren Buffett statement. He buys companies with a deep and wide competitive moat. That's what we call monopoly control. That's what Stephanie Breedlove had. She was the world's best payroll company for parents.
Yeah.
Got a nanny to pay. So that's one of the other drivers that you really want to focus on. What's the one thing that you could do better than anybody else?
Okay. That's interesting. I like that. I like that. I had another guest on the show that said riches come from niches or something like that. Niches bring the riches, whatever it was. And it took me a little while to just ponder that and think, maybe I've been doing it wrong this whole time.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've been trying to target essentially every small service business. in the end, maybe we should be more focused on that. So it's interesting.
Yeah, look, I think if you can carve out a really unique niche or niche, depending on where you are in the country.
Right.
I think, again, what do acquirers buy? They buy what they could not easily replicate.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, you really want to build something that you are the world's expert in, mm-hmm. to give you that competitive moat. I'm reminded of another guy I interviewed on my podcast named Jay Steinfeld. Jay built blinds.com. I don't know if you've ever heard his story, but an amazing story. He starts Blinds right around the time Jeff Bezos is selling books online. And he's like, well, if Bezos can sell books, I can sell blinds, right? Window coverings.
Right.
And turns out it's a lot harder to sell blinds than books online, because you gotta measure them, you gotta pick the fabric, you gotta install them. Like, it's really, but he sticks to it and he doesn't go off piste. He stays on Blinds online. That's all he does. And over, I guess, a 30-year run, 93 to, maybe more like 25-year run, he builds it to $100 million company just selling blinds.
Wow. That's a lot of blinds.
Yeah, it sure is. And it's enough to get the attention of Home Depot. Home Depot at the time was like a $90 billion company, but they were having problems in the blind space because Jay was beating them every day.
All right.
And so when they looked at blinds, they saw two things. Number one, a way to quickly leapfrog into the blinds category. But the other thing that is it was important to Home Depot, and it's sort of the hidden reason, there's a lot of strategics buy companies, is for them, they were struggling to get people to buy on their website. You think about your own behavior. If you want to get a new faucet for your kitchen, or you want to get a refrigerator, or you want to get some lumber, you don't go to homedepot.com. My guess is you probably go to a store.
Right.
But that's a whole lot more expensive for them to fulfill you coming into the store than it is to you to go, you know, doing a few clicks on the homedepot.com.
Right.
And so Home Depot is trying to get people to buy complicated products that need to be installed online.
Mm.
Sound familiar?
It does.
Exactly the nut that Jay Steinfeld had solved at Blinds.com. So they were getting a twofer when they bought Jay Steinfeld. Number one, they got leapfrogged into number one in the blinds category. But the other thing was that they could take that learning that he had discovered for complicated products that needed to be sold, selling them online, and graft it across their entire business, $90 billion of revenue.
Wow.
So they could get like 1% better at selling stuff online. That has massive impact for a $90 billion company.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm talking about when I talk about monopoly control. It's finding one thing that you can be the world's dominant player in, even if it's something as obscure as blinds.
Right.
If you can be the dominant player, you're creating monopoly control, and that's attractive to acquirers.
That is cool. That's very cool. So stuff like this, stuff that you learned from selling your business, writing the book, or is this more from helping clients and learning from their experiences that you were helping them along with?
A lot of it comes from Built to Sell Radio, to be honest. I mean, the tool Value Builder and the corresponding tools are all steeped in market research. They're rigorous research that allowed us to build those algorithms that run the tools. Okay. Then we've had tens of thousands of business owners go through it and validate the algorithm every day. So it is sort of self-healing, if you will, that regard. Yep. The stories I'm sharing with you today, the Stephanie Breedloves, the Jay Steinfelds, they all come from Built to Sell Radio, which is a podcast I do, where we interview a different entrepreneur every week and we ask them, tell me about your exit. And so we just interview people who have sold a company and we ask them about the things they would do differently if they had it all over to do again.
All right.
And so I equated a little bit, or a story I tell a lot is that, do you remember Sully, the guy who flew the airplane into the Hudson River?
Yeah.
You know, it goes back, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago now, but basically he was this legendary pilot that done everything there was to do in a plane. He was a trainer, had done, you know, flying every kind of airplane. Yet he never in his career had the opportunity to land an airplane on the Hudson River.
Right. It's probably a good thing.
For me, it's a perfect parallel for the entrepreneur, because as entrepreneurs, like, we do everything in our companies, right? We open the doors in the morning, we do the marketing plan, we hire the people, we deal with the customers, the complaints, we do it all. Mm-hmm. And you learn by doing over years and you get really good at what you do.
Right.
Just like Sully. And just like selling, no matter how good you are at selling your widgets or running your small company, you probably haven't got a lot of experience landing the plane on the Hudson. In other words, selling that company. You know, there's, you've sold a couple of businesses. That's rare. Most people only get one shot at it.
All right.
He had one shot to grease the landing. He had 95 lives at his, in his hands, right?
Yeah.
I think a lot of entrepreneurs, you know, you got one shot at this. You built this business over years, maybe decades. And they're just unforced errors that we make that I think can oftentimes wipe a lot of money off the table just by just knowing some simple things about how to maximize the value of your company. So that's kind of what we do with Built to Sell Radio.
Fair. You remind me of something because I've coached a few people selling their business. And I remember particularly there's one guy that was selling a company. He was making a six-figure income, probably working 15 to 25 hours a week.
How do I get that gig?
Yeah, so this is the thing. This is the thing. I feel like he was one of those guys that left a lot of money on the table because he was tired of the business.
Yeah,
he'd been working it for, I want to say, a neighborhood of 15 years. It was a commercial cleaning company, and he was essentially the guy that was on calls when an employee didn't show up at 2 a.m. to clean some bar.
Sure.
He had to get in the car and go mop up puke or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And he was tapped out. And I had found him a buyer, and the buyer was kind of lowballing. And I'm like, I think you can do better. I think you can do a lot better. And he essentially asked me, how long will it take? Like, it's tough to put a timeline on it, but I would say minimum 6 months, maybe a year or two, depending. Like, this is pretty focused type of buyer that you're trying to sell. In this market, you know, it's going to take a little while. And he's like, how fast can we sell it to this guy? It's like, ah. So I'm like, well, realistically, financing, so 6 weeks, you know, it depends how fast his bank will move. And he's like, just do it. But I think you could get a few $100,000 more. Mm. And he was just so tired of it. He just wanted to wash his hands, move on with his life.
You know, I'm so glad you share this story because I think it is the biggest error we make as entrepreneurs is we call it riding it over the top. Mm. But you hold on to your company too long. You hold on until you're tired, you're bored, you're frustrated, and then it's not worth anywhere near what it is when it's on an upswing. And right. I think this is just such a tragedy because you're absolutely right. Had you made a couple of tweaks to his business model, you know, negotiated from a position of strength, he could have gotten, you know, many, potentially even multiples more for what he had built, but he was exhausted and tapped out. And I think that's a tragedy. There, you know, there's an antidote to that or an alternative way of thinking. I call it the freedom point, which is where the sale of your company, along with whatever assets you built outside of your company, would create a nest egg large enough to live comfortably for the rest of your life.
All right.
And I think when you reach that point, I think it's worth pulling up and saying, do I want to continue? Do I want to get to the next level? Because the next level may not be something you value as much as the financial freedom you've created.
Fair. And what's the point, right?
Yeah. And if you've created, if you make that value liquid, if you hold it, you are effectively the gambler at the poker table has just won five hands, right?
Right.
And who knows when the next pandemic, the next recession is going to happen. And what you thought you had, which was financial independence, gets flittered away. So I think Buffett was the one who said, it's insane to risk something you value for something you do not.
Oh, and I like that.
It's such a simple term, which he's such a guru at. But I mean, the idea is, you know, for most of us as entrepreneurs, we don't want to be the next Elon Musk, the next Steve Jobs. Most of us, I think, are motivated by independence and freedom, right? Like that's our primary need, our primal need, if you will, right? Is independence. And so once you reach that, again, the freedom point, when you sell your business, the after tax proceeds is a big enough nest egg for you to basically have freedom to do whatever you want, to work if you want to, but not. I think it's just a really good moment to say, okay, is now the time. And you know, there's lots of other reasons to build a business beyond that point. Maybe you want to create a legacy, you want to build a, you know, like whatever But I think at least when you reach it, it's worth pulling up and saying, do I want to risk it? Is what, you know, is the next $1 million in revenue, the next 10 employees, is that worth it to me?
Right.
And maybe it is, maybe it isn't.
Mm-hmm. That's fair. I love that because that actually gives a trigger to actually saying, is now the time or is not, instead of just going your day to day and then thinking, yeah. Oh, wait, one of these days I should get out of here.
Yeah. I'll tell you a story on that. And because it's a tragic story, but I think it's one that people need to hear. It's from a guy named Rand Fishkin, who I interviewed maybe a year ago. He wrote a great book called Lost and Founder, but Rand built a company called Moz, SEO software, search engine optimization software. If you want to get ranked on.
Oh yeah. I know Moz.
Yeah. So Rand built it up 5 million or so in revenue, but it's growing quickly. He's expecting to get to 10. And he gets a call from a guy named Brian Halligan, who is a co-founder at HubSpot. Mm. And Halligan says, look, Rand, we're kind of weak on SEO. We love what you're doing. We want to buy your company. And Rand says, okay, how much? And he says, $25 million of cash and HubSpot stock. So this is a $5 million business. And he's offering them 5x revenue, which that's a pretty big number.
But my first thought is take it.
Yeah, exactly. But Rand had been told by some advisors that his business was probably worth 4x revenue. And remember, he was at 5, but he was getting to 10. And he thought there was a good chance he might get to 10 that year. Mm-hmm. And so he's doing the math on forward-looking, you know, revenue. Right. He's like, well, if we're at 10 and we could get 4x 10, that's 40. Mm-hmm. And he said, no. And so instead he... you know, continue to run the business. They raised some venture capital. The venture capitalists pushed him to build a bunch of products. None of them were really in his wheelhouse. They really started to bleed cash. The VCs ultimately removed Rand from the company.
Oh no.
And I interviewed him. I said, well, at least you've got your stock, right, Rand? And he said, you know what, John, based on the way the VCs invest, they use what are called preferred shares. And that means they get a preferred return. And based on the length of time they've held, my shares are probably worthless. And I said, but Rand, what would that offer from HubSpot be worth these days, given the appreciation of HubSpot stock now that it's public? Mm-hmm. And he said it would be worth close to $200 million.
No! Oh, ouch.
That's called riding it over the top.
All right.
And I, you know, Rand was gracious enough to share that story with me. And it was just a reminder that, you know, when you reach the freedom point, mm-hmm. and the sale of your business would basically give you enough money to do whatever the hell you want to do for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. It's worth pulling up and thinking about it.
Yeah.
It's worth thinking about it. And that may sound like greedy or money hungry. It's not intended to be that way. It's just that if your primary motivation to start a business was to create financial freedom, mm-hmm. and selling your business would give you that, then I think it's worth just saying, this is what I wanted, but I got to pull the trigger first.
Yeah. You could almost argue the whole greed or money hungry thing on the flip side.
You totally could. Yeah.
She's like, if you keep riding this, that's risk. Like you mentioned right now, you could essentially have what you're working for, your goal. You've achieved your goal as long as you say yes at this moment.
Exactly.
And then whatever you do from that point on is up to you. So, oh my gosh.
That's most entrepreneurs, they don't go to the beach. Like you couldn't live more than 3 months without having a business, right? Like you're like, I can't, you know, so I don't think.
I didn't know how. I thought I don't need an alarm clock. I got an alarm clock. Like I can't not do something. I don't even know how. My wife wants to go on vacation. She wants to sit on the beach. I don't even know how to just sit on the beach. Like I want to go see the world, meet some people, try the food, just check out other businesses where we're at. I don't find any fun in sitting still.
I think you're not alone though. I think most entrepreneurs are wired exactly the same way you are.
It's like
we love the innovation. We love the new thing. You know, we did some research a little while ago where we looked at the reasons owners end up regretting their decision to sell their company. Oh. And the number one reason is that they are all push and no pull, meaning they're all frustrations about their current business, which are pushing them out of their company. So it's frustrations with employees, frustrations with regulation, red tape, blah, blah, blah. Yet they're like, oh, I'll figure out what I want to go do after I sell my company. Mm. The most successful exits, the happiest people after exiting, are the ones that got really clear up front on their pull factors, which are the things they want to go do next.
Oh.
I interviewed a guy, this goes back a while. I think it was episode 100, Built to Sell Radio. His name was Sean Oshman, is Sean Oshman, 39 years old. He runs an IT consultancy, a couple million dollars in revenue. And he realizes he's been living in Denver his entire life. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I want to live on a sailboat. Like, that's a weird thought for a 39-year-old guy who's been living in Denver for a long time. Like, landlocked, there's no water.
Yeah,
anywhere.
Not a lot of water.
Yeah, it's not like he's from Miami or something like that. But he's like, no, I want to live on a sailboat. And so he commits that by his 40th birthday, he's going to live on a sailboat. And so he takes his business and he takes it to a broker. Broker comes back, gets him an offer of 2.6 times profit, and he accepts it. And I interviewed him on the show, and I'm like, but Sean, like 2.6 is like, in a baseball analogy, like that's a solid single, but it's not like hitting it out of the home, you know, the home run. Like, how come you're so happy? And he's like, yeah, John, I don't think you get it. Like, I live on a sailboat.
And it was accomplished.
Yeah. Like, it was like kind of touche. It was like, you know, my whole life is like, got to maximize value, got to maximize. And he was like, yeah, maximizing value is important, but actually what you want to go do next is probably even more important. And so, you know, I think it's a really important lesson for us to learn is that, like, before you sell, get really clear. Like, so you say you want to travel. Well, where do you want to travel to? What do you want to do while you're there? What food do you want to eat while you're there? What people do you want to meet? Like, get really clear. And I think that gives you the motivation and the focus to just to actually take it over the finish line and sell your company when so many others kind of just stay on through inertia, right? And then you ride it over the top.
That is cool. I like that. Man, that's, I always think of James Bond where Q was lowering. I think, I'm trying to think who the James Bond guy was at the time. But Q said, always have an exit strategy. It was the last one he did before he passed away.
I can't place which one. I've watched many of them, but they all kind of meld into one another these days. But,
yeah, right. It's all the same.
But have an exit strategy. I call it an options strategy, not stock options, but I like the idea of building a business that you could sell. Because when I do it, like when I do like a speech or whatever for a bunch of business owners, I'll say, like, how many of you guys want to sell? And like maybe of 100 business owners, I might get one person to raise their hand. Part of it, it's, I don't want to reveal to the world that I want to sell, right?
Oh, you're kidding.
Most people are like, no, I don't, like, no, I'm happy. I'm,
I just want to do this till I die. Business.
Yeah, I'll sell when I die, whenever, all that kind of stuff, right? And then I'll ask a different question. I'll say, okay, fair enough. How many of you would like to know you could sell your business if and when you're ready? And like every hand goes in the air at that point, right?
All right.
Because I think we all want to know that we're building an asset that it's got value, that when we're ready on our terms, we can sell. Mm-hmm. And that's what I mean by an option strategy. It's like building it so that you could sell it. And the definition of that, as we talked about in the very beginning of this conversation, is like, it can run without you.
Right.
And if it can run without you, you've got like the ultimate poker hand, right? Like you could sell. You could bring in a manager to run it. You could bring in a private equity group, sell 60% of it, keep 40% of it. You know, you could do any number of things and you've got all the cards at that point. But if it's a business that's dependent on you showing up, it's not really sellable and therefore you're kind of trapped in your company. So I think the most, you know, the most important thing to do is to get it to a point where it can thrive without you. And that just gives you all the cards.
That's cool. I like that. I remember when I sold my first business.
Yeah.
I realized that I own a job. And I gave myself essentially 6 months to remove myself from being necessary. I set up some ground rules where essentially I could still be a part of the business, but if I ever got hit by a bus, the business would still keep moving and not lose pace.
Fantastic.
And took a little bit to figure out what do you got to do? What do you have to invest in? Who do you have to hire? All that kind of stuff. But that made it way easier to sell. It made the company that ended up buying it, it was harder to convince them that I wasn't needed because they wanted to keep me on for 6 months. I'm like, no. Yeah, I've made it so that I'm not needed. But
so that part was interesting. I just interviewed a woman on Built to Sell Radio whose name forgive me, it's just slipped my mind.
That's right.
But it's one of the most recent episodes. She built a consultancy, a marketing agency that specialized in social media in the UK. And so if you know anything about marketing services businesses, they're almost always sold using an earnout where, you know, you get a little bit of money up front, but then you have to kind of hit a bunch of targets in the future. And if you do, with all things, you know, stars align, you get an extra payment. Well, she didn't want anything to do with an earnout. And so she went out and really structured the company so that it was no longer dependent on her. And she invested heavily her time primarily in building out processes, right? Employee manuals and processes for people to follow.
Yeah.
And I said to her, I said, like, I mean, that sounds like an entrepreneur's worst nightmare, sitting down and like writing processes for 3 months. Right. That sounds like the absolute like worst, you know, thing, way to spend your time. And she's like, yeah, I get it. It probably feels like being in jail, but if you wanted to be in jail, would you rather be in jail for 3 months or 3 years?
Ah.
And her point was that, yeah, take your medicine up front, right? Yeah, 3 months sucks. And productizing or systematizing your business is really boring work. Mm-hmm. But if you do it, you're going to really minimize the need for you to stay on with your acquirer for 2, 3, 4, 5 years, which for a lot of entrepreneurs is like a prison sentence, right? Right. Entrepreneur people love to do their own thing, the independence, the decision-making, the freedom. Working for a big company is like, it's the opposite of that. It's like right. torture for many. Mm-hmm. And so her point was, yeah, take your medicine now or take a whole lot more down the road.
Interesting.
Yeah. Jody Cook is her name. If you want to. Yeah. Jody Cook.
All right. Very cool. John, we, man, I feel like we could talk for hours because the whole exiting a business is such an important deal with businesses that I feel like is overlooked. By the majority of them, they spend so much time trying to start it and build it that they forget that there's an end game.
The last chapter. Yeah.
Yeah. There should be an end game, I guess, as far as that goes, outside of dying. So at any rate, John, where can people find you?
Just head over to builttosell.com. We've got some bunch of things there that that folks can take a look at. So yeah, just builttosell.com.
Okay. And then the value builder system, is there a link to that on there as well?
That's valuebuilder.com.
Gotcha. Well, easy enough, right? And then Value Builder, where I found it was through a coach. Can people use that independently?
No, we 100% of our users for Value Builder do so at the invitation of an advisor. So we call them certified Value Builders. Okay. So Value Builder is actually, it's a practice management software for advisors, business coaches, and they use it with their clients. So,
gotcha.
If folks are interested, we can get them in touch with a certified value builder. Just go to valuebuilder.com.
Gotcha. Very cool. Very cool. And then your podcast, where can people find that?
Anywhere good podcasts are available. So, Stitcher, Spotify, Built to Sell, or iTunes. It's just called Built to Sell Radio.
Gotcha. Awesome. Well, John, thank you so much for being on the show. This is super cool.
Hey, thanks, James. It was good to be with you.
I am impressed with how many people and how many businesses that you have helped through this, and you make it seem so simple, but it's maybe it is
easy for me to say, hard to do, but I think a worthwhile investment.
Very cool. Very cool. This has been Authentic Business Adventures, the business program that brings you the struggle stories and triumphant successes of business owners across the land. We are underwritten locally by the Bank of Sun Prairie. If you're listening to this on the web, which you probably are, please be sure to give a thumbs up, comment, subscribe, and of course, share with your entrepreneurial friends. My name is James Kademan, and Authentic Business Adventures is brought to you by Calls on Call, offering call answering and receptionist services for service businesses across the country on the web at callsoncall.com, as well as Draw In Customers Business Coaching, offering business coaching services for entrepreneurs looking for growth on the web at drawincustomers.com. And of course, The Bold Business Book, a book for the entrepreneur in all of us, available wherever fine books are sold. We'd like to thank you, our wonderful listeners, as well as our guest, John Warlow, author of Built to Sell, host of the Built to Sell podcast, and founder of the Value Builder System. This guy just helps people exit businesses, which is awesome. Oh, what else we got here? Past episodes, of course, can be found morning, noon, and night, the podcast link, found at drawincustomers.com. John, thank you so much for being on the show. This is a lot of fun.
Thanks, James.
All right. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next week. I want you to stay awesome. And if you do nothing else, of course, enjoy your business and make sure that you exit it rich, right?